You're listening to Bands and Botanicals, a unique podcast where trainer and trainee discuss fitness, herbalism, and healthy habits for life. We're your hosts. I'm Paula Kirsch, owner of Botanically Curious and artisan herbalist.
And my name is Danielle Kreese, certified personal trainer and owner of DC Fit. Now, before we get started, if you could do us a brief favor and go to Apple Podcasts and just leave us a review, we'd love to hear from you. And with that being said, let's start the show.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, beautiful internet people, I guess. Podcast world.
People who have some kind of smartphone.
People of the airways. Yes.
Well, hello, good morning, afternoon, evening. Who knows what time it is
where you are. Yeah, it could be anywhere. We have another kind of travel episode for you, which we're really looking forward to. Shifting now, we kind of had a more tropical, warm Caribbean beach vibe that we had going on yesterday, all the things I have been dreaming about. And now we are moving about a little bit more into some mountain medicine.
Yeah, I love this. You know, I took a minute yesterday to really realize the progression of this month, where we started kind of in India and we used the spice trade and kind of went into Jamaica and some of the islands in the Caribbean there. And then now coming into the U.S., we're going to be talking about the Appalachian Mountains and mountain magic, because that was a little thing we dabbled in. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of progresses on a timeline in history, really, in the way that things have moved through. And so I think that's really great. So we're moving across the world and doing some fun stuff, and I'm excited to get started.
Yeah, and I will kind of be giving you some tips and tricks about if you were doing hikes, whether they're bigger hikes, you know, big backpacking trips that you're doing for extended periods of time, or just smaller hikes like day trips that you may be taking with your friends or your family. And then I'm also going to give you some actual places for you to go to. These are places that I've been to, also some local places, but just maybe little spots that you can mark on your map and check out and see if you could incorporate into some travels. Because I keep saying it over and over, but I need to get back to that. And I'm sure other people are feeling it too. So here are some ideas for you.
Yeah, you know, thinking about this episode and thinking about herbalism in general, when I started doing a lot of the lessons that I had when I was going through my herbalism courses and things, one question that really stood out to me that still does a lot of the time is, why do women normally gravitate toward these healing methods with herbs and these more like folk medicine things? And really what I came around after, you know, looking at my experiences, the experiences of people I knew, is really just the evolutionary resourcefulness women had to have. And what that really means is, over time, you know, thousands of years ago up until now, this evolutionary process that's happened where women have always had to be resourceful with the things that they've had. You know, they most likely had limited resources, but they're also the caretakers in their families, in their communities. So they're taking care of themselves or taking care of their children, their families, their communities, like I said. And that's really what folk herbalism is. And I think it's really great, whether you're you say Appalachia or Appalachia or Appalachian mountains, you know, there's no denying that there's definitely magic within it. And so really excited to talk about it.
I think that's cool that you brought that up, because, you know, it definitely delves into like the traditional gender roles and kind of what women were expected to do and provide versus men who kind of did the hunting and kind of did the more laborious work. But I wonder, because, you know, herbalism and kind of getting reconnected, as much as right now I think our generation and the generations that are coming out after us are obviously very connected to technology and everything. I do feel like there is this movement of people who are trying to get back to the connection of this earth. And a lot of people are going into herbalism. And I wonder if, as we continue to evolve and, you know, gender roles are changing now, things are becoming more fluid, genders are becoming more fluid. So I do wonder if we're going to see in the future an increase of men who practice herbalism, just because maybe just like we felt we were stuck in certain roles, I think men have also felt stuck in certain roles. And maybe now, like, it'll be interesting to see if in the future, like, I wish we could almost come back and see it for ourselves, if men started to develop these more caretaker roles as well, because you do see more stay-at-home fathers these mm-hmm. days, and just things changing. So I don't know, just a thought. I wonder if it'll change and you'll just see a little shift.
Yeah, there's definitely, not to say that there's not men in the industry and there's not mm-hmm. men doing those things. There's a ton of, you know, even celebrity gardeners that are men.
Historically though, right?
Like, yeah. But you know, when we're talking about homesteading and some of the things that I do, where, you know, I'm the one who's mostly tending to the gardens and making sure the chickens have what they need and all of those things that really embody the home, which is so different than how really I grew up and some of the things I used to do. But it's nice to get back to that kind of homesteading, that quiet lifestyle.
It's so funny because I guess in my home, we are in the opposite, because mm-hmm. just right now with me being focused on training and trying to build up that part of myself, Jeff has been the one who has become the homesteader and is kind of always in the garden. He's the one that's always planting and cultivating and doing all of these things. And mm-hmm. eventually I want to be there to join him. This is just my focus now, but it's just, yeah, I mean, different homes, different things, and just different shifts through time. It's interesting.
Yeah. So getting back to homesteading in the Appalachian Mountains and these families that really had to cultivate from what they had. You know, I was driving up here this morning before the podcast, just loving the fact that we're in spring, how green everything is, mm-hmm. the songbirds. I mean, it was fantastic. And it's so picturesque in Talent, especially if you're on Wagner and you're just driving up here and just the mountains with the pear orchards.
Everything in bloom, yeah.
Oh my goodness. And so, you know, it really made me feel at one with what some of these people probably experienced when you don't have the opportunity to be in an urban city or closer to hospitals or doctors or any of those things. You know, this is where the folk medicine really comes in, because this rugged topography, if you're up in the mountains really high and say you're in labor, you're sick, you've got something that, you know, you need a doctor for, sure, some physicians would come up all the way up into the mountains, but they would also charge a lot. And a lot mm-hmm. of these rural communities didn't have the money to really afford that. And so it was really up to the women within the family to heal the sick and tend to the dying, see their women through labor. And that's just really what we're talking about here. And just this way of living that wasn't necessarily backed with science at the time. And now we're seeing, you know, all of this common sense that they accumulated over the years and passed down from generation to generation. We're kind of seeing that more and more, which I think is fantastic. You know, like using elderberry from the yard for coughs, mm-hmm. right? Now we see this all the time, especially if you're an herbalist or you're on Instagram and you pay attention to a lot of the herbalist. Elderberry is like the number one thing you'll hear in the winter when we start getting those coughs and those colds, mm-hmm. or catnip tea, you know, for croup, which is just something a little bit thicker of a cough and some of those things.
For the catnip, is that something that kids could have as well? Because I always had croup mm-hmm. as a young child.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do adults get it as
I think it's more of something where you've got a little bit more underdeveloped mm-hmm. aspect into it. And so I always, especially for those listening, I always shy away from using a lot of herbs with kids unless you're very knowledgeable about what you're doing, or you've been directed by an herbalist or a doctor or something else to do that, just because it's kids, you know,
right.
Like some of those things like honey is really great unless you're a baby, because it'll suffocate your baby. Don't give your baby honey, you know, things like that. Yeah. Right. You don't have children, so I guess that wouldn't be common sense, but things where, you know, it's a little bit trickier with kids. So I would say, yes, it definitely is something that, has been prescribed for kids, especially with folk herbalism and medicine, but it's something where if you're not knowledgeable, you know,
yeah, just,
yeah.
Do your research.
Absolutely. The other thing that I wanted to mention was we talked about calamus probably in one of our first or second episodes. We had a mm-hmm. pain episode and we were talking about calamus. And this is another one where in folk herbalism, especially in the Appalachian Mountains, they were using whatever they had. And so calamus root, if they had the root, they would prescribe that to their neighbors and, you know, their families as a stew. They would cut the root in, put it into a stew, and that would kind of soothe colic, which happens mm. a lot with babies as well. And so interestingly, when you start learning about calamus now, and you know that there's things like the energetics and what you're paying attention with that, there's the warming, carminative kind of aspect where it's pushing things through the body. We talked about it as a pain reliever mm-hmm. for that reason, antimicrobial. So it's dissolving the phlegm and some of those things to really open up airways and those sensory orifices. So when you've got a cold, when you're stuffed up, some of those things, it's really interesting because it was just passed down generation to generation.
I was an anthropology major in university, and I think about this quite often, and maybe you do too, but I always like to think, like, who's the first person that tested all of these things? I mean, that you see a gnarly fruit, some fruit looks so inviting, you know, some berries look so inviting, some herbs, even some flowers, they look so inviting, but then there are other things and you're just like, eh, I guess we're gonna see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I wonder who was that first person. Or you see a, because did you say that calamus was kind of like a grass?
So it comes up as a grass, but you use the root underneath of it.
Like, how does someone figure that out? It always mm-hmm. blows my mind how people have been able to figure this out, because you think, you look around, and we probably have even less abundance than what people of the past had, because mm-hmm. so many things have been, what, monocultured now?
Right, and eroded, and yeah.
That I couldn't imagine just trying to figure it all out.
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing, especially for those who go out and they're looking to forage and start collecting herbs themselves, and they're a little weary about some of that. Thankfully, we have the internet now, so mm-hmm. it's great to double check some of those things, and fantastic apps like Picture This, where you can take a picture of it and double check what it is before you harvest it or whatever. But, you know, even chickens are able to realize what they can and can't eat. And I mentioned chickens randomly because I had someone ask me the other day, you know, I have these things in my yard, they're poisonous. I found out like foxglove is poisonous to chickens. Mm. Should I rip it out? Because my chickens, it's like nature isn't trying to trick you. If it tastes gross most of the time, if it's bitter and some of those other things, there's most likely some kind of poisonous attribute to it. And so like a chicken will maybe go after something if it's totally starving, but it's not going to eat things that don't taste good just for the sake of eating it. You know what I mean? They're pretty smart with that, where it's like, oh, blackberries, they're safe to eat. They taste good. They're fine. You know, so it's just kind of a lot of that common sense, where if you are in tune with yourself and with nature, you can test a lot of that in a safe way, where you're not obviously eating a big giant bunch of calamus or a big giant mm-hmm. bunch of this or that or the other thing before you realize
yeah.
what it
yeah.
is.
It's just even that just like initial like, that's a grass. I wonder if it could help me. Like just that first, like the conception of the idea of choosing a plant to be like, let me see what this does, is just always mind blowing to me.
Yeah. I think that's why I really love folk medicine, because it is really that practice of being so in tune with the environment around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So cool. So I'm going to start giving a couple of tips over here. I actually was reading this really great article on thehikinglife.com. I am not a professional hiker, so I had to do a little bit of my own research. I want to get better at it, and I hope this helps you as well, because it's a lot of stuff that may seem like common sense, but in the moment you may not think about because you're wrapped up in everything that you're doing. So this article was actually written by Cam Honan, and Backpacker Magazine named him as one of the most traveled hikers on earth. So I could only imagine the places he has been and the things he has seen. But I really liked this quote that he had mentioned, and it was from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it was that the civilized man has built a coach but has lost the use of his feet. And I think it's so true. I mean, you know, sometimes you hear about people even talking about how we're too reliant on shoes. We've lost that connection of toes to the ground and like really feeling grounded in what we're doing. So I just liked that quote, especially going into the idea of this. So just a couple of general tips to start off with, and then I'm going to break it down between hiking uphill and downhill. But the pace. Mm-hmm. A lot of people may think that you want to start off nice and hard or something because that's when you feel most energized, like take advantage of that energy. But you want to aim to finish the day walking at the same speed that you started. So the idea of that is to not fly and die, because you may start super invigorated, but especially if you're on those longer walks, even if it's a day hike and you have 10 miles ahead of you round trip.
Right.
I mean, you don't want to be potentially injuring yourself or be so fatigued that you lose your focus and you lose your balance as you're going downhill. So you don't want to bound yourself uphill without thinking about the entirety of your hike.
Right.
So it's kind of like even if you're doing interval work mm-hmm. or you're running on the treadmill, I mean, you could do burpees for 45 seconds and you could go super, 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 super hard and only be able to last 25 seconds before you have to take a break. Or you could pace yourself, think about it more methodically, and then you could hit three rounds of 45 without having to take a break. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that same concept. Pack adjustments. So making regular little micro small adjustments to the pack. So I discovered this a lot without even realizing it while I was backpacking. But just like lifting it up, tightening it for a second so that it sits in a different place, tightening maybe around your shoulders so that sits in a different place. And then always, you know, lifting for a second, kind of placing the weight differently, because especially if you're doing a really long hike, you'll start to develop sores if you're not used to packing light as well, because packing is part of the challenge, right. I think. I don't know if you've ever seen Wild with Reese Witherspoon, but her pack was huge mm-hmm. and it was just sitting so heavy on her for so long that she was developing sores and bruising on her hips and on her shoulders. And imagine you're doing or trying to attempt a longer hike. That's going to be miserable. Mm-hmm. So those small adjustments can prevent, it's like when you have bed sores,
right?
Like staying in the same place is what you're trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
You could also mix up the way that you walk and your stride. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you could take longer strides. Sometimes you can make them a little shorter, maybe a little bit quicker. You could also kind of maybe bounce more up on the heels. More up on the toes at certain points, or sit a little bit more far back in the heels, because it's the idea that you don't want to be using the same exact muscles for hours or days on end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's when they're really going to be overly tight, overly worked, overly trained. So it's the same idea of when you make those small shifts with your pack, is that you're just trying to shift kind of the weight, shift the intention, and those small regular movements will add up so that you don't feel big pain later on.
Mm-hmm.
This may seem like an obvious one, but I think we are all guilty of not stretching enough, even as a professional. I'm actually trying to get better at that. But you could stretch during your breaks, and these aren't huge, long stretching sessions, but just giving back to the body that you're demanding so much of. So just stretching a little bit so you don't get really, really tight throughout the hike. And then just giving yourself about 10 or 15 minutes at the end of the hike. I mean, usually like you want to, but then, and I've been there, you also want to just sit your ass down
mm-hmm.
and just like, that release that comes when you take that last step off the trail.
Right.
But you're going to be able to last longer, again, especially if you're doing multiple day hikes or something, to give your body back a little bit of love and a little bit of attention from what you have asked of it. And then the last kind of general tip, and then I'm going to pass it back to Paula, is the type of breaks that you're taking.
Mm.
So a lot of people may try, and I'm guilty of this, so this was actually really insightful for me, is you try to push as long as you possibly can,
mm-hmm.
but then you feel like a short break isn't enough. Like you almost want to sit there for longer and longer because you've just gone balls to the wall as hard as you can. So instead of taking spread out really long breaks where your muscles then have time to start to tighten
mm-hmm.
and to start to feel really stiff, you could short and regular breaks instead would be better. So not just that, but if your breaks are shorter, even though you're taking them a little bit more frequently, you may be able to cover more time because you won't get it stiff. So it won't take as long to kind of find your stride once you get back into it. So these may seem like obvious things, but we may not think about them while we're in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's so important because we've got tons of opportunities here locally in the Valley to go hiking and all of those things. And it's so much a part of just active culture, right? And just mm-hmm. like, hey, it's a weekend, I'm going to go. It's exactly what I did over the weekend. It started to get really sunny in the valley, so we decided to go up in the mountains while it was still snowing. And we had to park the car and walk a mile and a half to the trailhead. Well, it was continuously uphill because mm-hmm. you're supposed to be driving up the mountain to get to the trailhead. And so I knew I didn't want to burn anything out before I even got to the trail. So I was walking forward for a while. Then I turned around and walked backwards for a while. Then you know, and did that alternating.
Yeah.
And then just enjoying the trail. You know, we've talked about this before where you put your head down, you just barrel through the trail. You get to the top, you take your picture, you barrel back down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, how fast can I do this? But one of the things I like to do is just, you know, every so often stop, take a quick photo, maybe adjust some things, identify some plants around of what I'm doing, really just take in and then keep going. So it's not those long, you know, stays that you're talking about, but it's just quick enough to take a photo, stretch real quick, and then keep walking.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing that, especially if you're doing something for like 10 miles throughout mm-hmm. the day and it's not something you normally do. You can be a very active person and consider yourself an active person, but if you're not continuously like running 5 miles a day or some of those things, and then as soon as the weather gets nice, all of a sudden you want to do 10 miles. And it's, even though it's just walking, it's going to really affect your body.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're not working with elevation ever, mm-hmm. if you're not, I mean, even just with your breathing,
right.
Let alone just elevation and how that affects, you know, your muscles. You think about walking mm-hmm. up some stairs or something. I think being from Miami and it being so flat all the time, and then, you know, only in my later years did I really start hiking mountains and stuff. I work out 5 or 6 days a week religiously.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff, who does physical stuff all the time, but not like that quote unquote gym type of workout, but he's from Canada and he's been hiking and going up mountains his entire life. That fool frustrates me so much. Not a fool, he's a very fine man. But he bounds up that mountain like no one's problem.
Right.
And I'm just like huffing and puffing. And it's because it's different. It's mm-hmm. different from the way that I train. And that's why, you know, taking it a little bit slower, like, and listening to your body, because just because you do a gym workout and you know how to lift some weights,
right,
or do even a lot of burpees, doesn't mean that it's going to translate the same when you're walking up an entire mountain.
Yeah. I love the fact that we tie into altitude, because that really is something that contributes to kind of that magic in the mountains, quote unquote, that we talk about, because really what we've seen is that plants that survive in higher altitudes are a lot more resilient. You know, this isn't the stuff in the Midwest, these flat plains of like GMO corn, or not something that's been genetically modified to be pest resistant.
Mm-hmm.
This is a natural evolution that happens because up in the mountains, there's a lack of water, there's colder temperatures, there's all of these things that the plants need to survive through. And so what ends up happening is they develop higher amounts and better varieties of these secondary metabolites. And we talk about phytochemistry a lot of the time. The primary metabolites are the ones that help with like photosynthesis and all of those things, really just the growth of the plant and the reproduction of the plant. These secondary metabolites are the ones that we really focus on when we start talking about the benefits of the plants to us when we consume them. And so secondary metabolites can be classified into 4 sections. You've got your terpenoids, you've got your alkaloids, you've got your sulfur-containing components, and then your phenolic compounds. And so those phytochemicals are really like antimicrobial. They can attract or repel things, and it's a way for the plant to survive. So if you really look at the plants up in the mountains as they're stronger, you consume them, now you're stronger, you're absorbing a lot of those metabolites and those constituents like you would when we talk about energetics and chemical constituents within it. So it's really interesting to look at those. You can look at the plant's secondary metabolites is like their skill set. You know, they've got the core of what they do. And so it's really interesting and neat to see that the plants that thrive and the species that thrive, it's because they're stronger. You know, it's like beating out the weaker ones. And, you know, there's tons of different cultures that believe in, you know, even just eating parts of really strong animals like Native Americans and things that I think if they eat like the liver or the heart of like a bear or something else, they're absorbing those properties.
Right.
It's the same thing with folk medicine. And we see now that we're getting into the science of phytochemistry and the plants and things that, yeah, there is something to that.
That's really cool, because like whenever I'm working out with people outside, I'm always encouraging them to be inspired by the strength of the natural properties around us, the strength, you know, and this sounds weird, I sound woo-woo, but whatever, and integrity of like the mountains and the trees that have stood for all of these hundreds of years, despite everything that's happened in this earth. And it's cool that you say this, because with these especially these higher mountain herbs, you're like literally absorbing their strength. You're not just a you know, inspired by their strength, which is really neat.
Yeah. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the mountain herbs that you'd find around the Appalachian. And so it means a really long mountain range. It goes from Canada all the way to the Alabama, like northern Alabama.
It's 2,180 miles to be exact.
And so, you know, it's definitely going to have a vast variety of things, but some of the ones that I just wanted to bring in there that we've seen, one in particular that we see a lot, and it's very common in cosmetics, which is witch hazel, and mostly used as like an astringent skin cleanser a lot of the time. But the neat thing is that it blooms in the autumn rather than the spring, which is kind of neat. So it's just anybody who's ever gardened who realizes that they have to have different varieties throughout the season to just continuously have, you know, some color and some diversity in there. I think that's really fantastic. And pharmacists have actually used the extract from the bark and the leaves in alcohols and all kinds of things for a really long time. And so that's why it's not only in drugstores for facial cleansers, but insect bites, sunburns, poison ivy, you know, you name it. Witch hazel is really in a lot of things because of its astringent properties.
Dang. Yeah, I've used witch hazel for acne before, but I didn't realize. I mean, I guess it makes sense. I've just only used it for that one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So neat.
Yeah.
I was going to talk about hiking uphill really quick because there is a difference between hiking uphill and downhill. When you're hiking uphill, you do kind of want to make sure that you find your rhythm. This goes back to that original tip of finding your pace, but it's not just about the pace. It's finding this connection between your stride and your breath. If you work out with me or around me, I'm always really trying to emphasize the use of your breath in order to help you move your weight, but not just that, in order to help kind of regulate so that you could keep moving. If you're breath is really fluctuated. If you're holding your breath, you're going to have to take more breaks. Your heart rate's going to feel higher. But if you could regulate it and you could find kind of this rhythm, like I said, with your breath and with your movement, then it's going to support what you're doing. And it's the same thing with hiking, with running, with all of that stuff. We talked about just taking those kind of more regular steady breaks because you want to keep the heart rate a little bit more constant. You don't want to have these huge big fluctuations because then it's harder to get back into. So it's not just about your muscles but also about your heart rate. So you'll actually kind of expend less energy and cover more distance if you just have like steady breaks versus like trying to go as long as you possibly can and then take a break where you need all of this extra time.
Mm-hmm.
Positive mindset. I mean, this may seem obvious, but sometimes people go into the hike with fear already and almost this sense of dread, like, oh my God, I have this huge long way. How am I going to do this? I'm not going to be able to make it to the top. It's going to hurt too much. Mm-hmm. If you go into it, just like anything else, you're setting yourself up. Don't create that reality for yourself. Give yourself an opportunity to succeed. You don't want to walk 10 miles thinking negative shit the entire time.
Right.
I mean, it's just not going to feel good. You're not going to get the mental benefits of it. So again, while this may seem obvious, set yourself up for success, not just physically, but mentally as well. And then the last one I have for the uphill is to zigzag in order to decrease the steepness of the grade. So if you have that little zigzag, it's kind of like when you do switchbacks. That's right. Why they have switchbacks, because some mountains are just too steep for you to go on a direct trail straight up. So think about when you do switchbacks, it's the same idea if you have that space on a trail to kind of zigzag your way up to decrease the grade of it.
Yeah, I think that's really great. And that's something that I probably try to do. I'm not good on super steep uphill climbs a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I kind of need to zigzag back and forth. But setting the tone for the Appalachian Mountains, you know, we're in early spring right now. Things are really green, really moist. there's some kind of richness in the soil. And in the Appalachian forest, that is exactly where blue cohosh is blooming right now. So it's really center stage in the Appalachian mountains right now, where it's just blooming. You can see it before a lot of other things do. And so that's why I really wanted to mention it today, because it's one that I really enjoy using. It's one that in folk medicine has been used. It's something where herbalists really use the roots to treat things like rheumatism. It's been used for women for reproductive reasons and just strengthening the uterine functions of it. So it's really great in a lot of those things, even potentially increase in fertility. So, you know, as an herbalist, when you're a little more, I guess, confident in the herbs that you use, you can kind of start going into some of these like blue cohosh and a few others that you might find even if you're hiking a lot of the time. So it's a really great one. I just wanted to mention that. And indigenous tribes actually used it a lot of the time for like menstrual cramps, colic, rheumatism, like I mentioned, and indigenous Native Americans is really what I'm talking about here. So it's been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Another one that I really wanted to mention, just because I wanted to get a good variety of different kinds of health arenas that we could really focus on, which is Queen Anne's lace is another really great one. And this one is really strong and hardy in terms of just pushing things out of the body. We've talked about some herbs in the past. This one is really just to eliminate like intestinal worms and gas and kidney stones, actually. So it really breaks down a lot of that crystallization that happens and pushing that through the body. And so, you know, it's the roots of it are really rich in vitamin A, but like I said, you don't want to take it excessively because it is really, really powerful and kind of pushing in through your body. It can be really harmful a lot of the time too. And obviously this is one where if you're pregnant, you're not going to want to even use it, but we're talking about folk herbalism right now. We're talking about some things that you don't necessarily use all of the time, but it's kind of fun. And then one that's my absolute favorite that is in gardens and used all the time because it is such a great pollinating plant, which is bee balm. And so it's literally bee balm. There's so many different species and varieties of it. You can get like basil bee balm, lemon bee balm, bergamot.
And that would be different from a lemon balm?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's just different species of the Monarda. And so when you get into herbalism, a lot of the time you'll start getting into the Latin names of those, and then you can see the different species because of that. There's different varieties that'll grow and need different kinds of growing conditions, which I won't really get into today. But this one is really fantastic. It's got a diffusing effect to it, and it's got some cooling and drying. So diffusing, similar to Tulsi in the way we talked about, it kind of brings it up and out. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about diffusing kind of a lot of those things. So it's going to be stimulating maybe a little bit, but then that cooling effect comes afterwards. And that's why I really enjoy it. It's fantastic for all kinds of pollinators. I think it is such a fantastic looking plant. It's really unique. And I really personally like growing things that look unique, that also help with pollinators. Bees, butterflies, hummingbirds love bee balm. And it was just one that also is used and grows in the Appalachian Mountains, so which is really fantastic. So also the Oswego Indians use it for treating colds and sore throats because it clears the sinuses. A lot of so the aromatic oils have been used in teas and perfumes and all of those things. So very versatile, used in folk medicine, used for hundreds of years, and something that you can just find growing in your garden now.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Love it. So we are moving downhill now. We've reached the top. We've reached the summit. We've taken some pictures. We've eaten some lunch, we've refueled our body, and now we're about to head downhill. Now, downhill, even though some people assume that this is the easier part of the hike, I've actually always found downhill to be quite challenging just because you're tired. You kind of may be in a different, trying to take a different pace because you want to finish it. You kind of rounded things out. Lights at the end of the tunnel, especially if you have a really long hike. And then also, you know, you feel that there's a lot of wear and tear on the joints. So people mostly find that they complain about their knees more on the way down than they ever complain about their knees on the way up. So there are a lot of falls and slips that happen when you go downhill, again, because you're trying to finish, your legs may be tired, you know, you don't have that same vigor. So a lot of ways, here are some ways that you can keep yourself safe, essentially. So prepare your gear before you start that descent. Maybe retighten your bag because you want to minimize the shifting of your pack. You're probably already a little bit fatigued. Your legs may feel a little bit wobbly. And if you're on, you know, especially around here in Southern Oregon, there are a lot of mountains where you have like scree that you're climbing up and down. So those are kind of like loose rock a bit. So you don't want anything that's going to contribute to you losing your balance. Right. So kind of tightening your pack, making sure that you could find your center of gravity. That being said, a center of gravity. A lot of the times, you know, you may think you should lean back or lean forward, but you mostly want to be low and over your legs. So kind of bend your knees, get low, and shorten your strides as you're making your way down. And this is going to help to not just minimize the impact of walking downhill, but possibly prevent those slips and those falls. Because think about it, by lowering your center of gravity, that lever is smaller and you just don't have that same possibility. In order to, again, minimize the impact of walking downhill, you know, that feeling you get in your knees, you want to keep your downhill legs slightly bent in order to absorb the impact. So I've talked about this sometimes with people who have trained with me because we don't just do box jumps or step ups. Those are great for practicing your hike uphill. You're building your quad muscles, you're building your glute muscles. But if you want to practice going downhill and you want something that's going to be accessible to you in the gym that you could literally tangibly practice, a step down or a jump down is what you want to try to do because you're bending your legs as you hit that ground and you're thinking about absorbing the impact. And that could kind of translate to the way that you walk downhill as well to keep yourself a little bit safer. This will also kind of help strengthen your muscles. So in working out, you have a lot of eccentric, like slow movements, time under tension. So this is kind of the same with having that bend in your leg, with absorbing that impact. It's going to move more into your muscles rather than your joints. If you do have poles, adjust them as needed. You know, going up, you may be able to keep them a little bit shorter, but going down, you may have to make them a little bit longer because you never want to be, again, with that forward kind of like fold. You don't want to be arching or bending at your lower back where you're like almost moving if you're in a hinge, if you could kind of visualize that. So adjust as need be. Travel light. Heavy load equals more stress on the joints, obviously. As light as your skill and as, you know, the time frame in which you are hiking will allow. Obviously, those are all factors. And then the last thing for this portion is just to stay focused. You need to fight the fatigue. A lot of times you could kind of lose that focus, as I mentioned in the beginning of this portion, when you're going downhill. Maybe you're just trying to finish it off. But it's not worth risking the injury just so you could get finished, what, half an hour earlier, right? 15 minutes earlier, maybe. So just think about the long term. That's what kind of this is all about. All of these tips are so that you could stay successful and continue to hike throughout your life. And then the last thing that I wanted to talk to you all about was just a couple of actual places that you may be able to literally research, dream about, mark on your calendar, and hopefully tackle one day. So in Taiwan, they have a mountain called Jade Mountain, and it's the fourth largest mountain on any island. And you could go up, they have kind of base camp. It's, you could do it in one day, but it's quite challenging, but it's some of the most breathtaking views on the island. It's definitely, if I'm not mistaken, it's the tallest point on, in Taiwan. I think if I remember correctly, it's somewhere between 10 to 12,000 feet, if I remember. And once you get up there, you get up there at sunrise, and it's just the most fulfilling, satisfying feeling. And if you don't think it's a workout, then you're crazy. There are also little things you could do, like if you visit places locally, some places may have pilgrimages. I feel like especially in these countries where tea and tea ceremony is really important. Mm-hmm. So in Kaohsiung, where we lived in Taiwan, it's the second biggest city in Taiwan. They have a mountain called Monkey Mountain, and they have on top of it a temple. And you could volunteer to take up these kind of like backpacks of water to the people who, you know, handle the temple and give away tea once you get to the top. So you get this feeling of satisfaction, and not just the physical aspect of it, but kind of the service of it. Even if you're not, you don't have to be Buddhist or any of these things. It's just, you climb this mountain, you accomplish this thing, and there's someone waiting for you at the top to give you some tea for you to sit down, reflect, enjoy. And you could be a part of that kind of tradition. And I've done that, and it is a huge workout, because think about what water does. If we talked about not wanting your pack to shift, water is bringing a lot of movement into your workout. So luckily, this particular mountain, it's mostly kind of steps on the way up, but you know, you're bringing a whole element where you have to engage your core and your stabilizers, because that water is shifting with every step.
Right.
Kamakochi is in Japan. They're known as the Japanese Alps. That is probably enough said. So many hiking opportunities. Probably one of the most stunning places I've ever been in my life. Mount Batur is a volcano you could do in Bali. So you hike this volcano, you start at like 1 a.m., you reach it at sunrise. And again, it's things that you could place into your workout that's gonna be movement. I also laid my ass down on a beach for many days in Bali, but I wanted to make sure that I had these little kind of like bursts of adventure and movement to keep my mind and my body feeling good. And then locally, I mean, there are a lot of places, but if you're visiting Southern Oregon, Wagner is a great trail. It's about 10 miles round trip. It's a really gradual climb, I feel, but it still keeps you challenged. Obviously, there's Mount Shasta in California, but there are a lot of people. I thought it was an obvious mountain that everyone knew about, but some people don't. Mm. So it's a really stunning mountain. The best times to do it, especially if you're kind of more of a beginner climber, is June and July, because one of the passes is more accessible, and this one's a little bit easier for kind of new mountaineers. You could get a guide. I'm actually going to try to summit it this summer for the first time, and you could have someone be there with you to kind of help you through it and help you navigate it, because there are some technical parts to that climb. We also have Mount McLaughlin. We have Mount Thielson. If we wanted to just have an episode of local mountains you could hike, it would be a bajillion hours long.
Well, and then really in Southern Oregon, and Washington, we got the Ring of Fire, which is hiking all the volcanoes, essentially, which obviously aren't active volcanoes at this point, but it's really interesting. There's like 12 or 14 of them within a 6-hour radius.
I mean, this whole area between, I think, Oregon, California, and Washington is literally endless possibilities.
Right.
Of climbing and hiking and forests and lakes and all of that stuff. And just a little reminder, just to give you some creativity, if you're out in the forest and you wanna, you know, maybe create a circuit for yourself or kind of try to use those natural elements to do some more general kind of like gym type of movements, if you have a big gigantic stump, you could use that as a box jump or a bench. You have trees, especially maybe if you're in a jungle, because sometimes you may have lower branches than big forest trees. You could use that as a pull-up bar. The elevation changes you come across are your incline and decline of your treadmill. The rocks that surround you are your weights. The logs can be your balance trainers. So you could do different things trying to balance on those logs. And the mountains are your inspiration. So just keep an eye out. I'm going to actually post a workout I did when I was in Yosemite. So a couple ideas you could take from that. And other than that, I think our mountain podcast is coming to a wrap.
Yeah. So next time you're out, you're hiking the mountains, maybe try to plan on identifying a few things, taking a few photos, share those with us, share those with others, and just have fun with it and know that anytime you're out in nature is time well spent.
Yeah, the mountains are calling and we must go to them. Have a beautiful day, everyone. Peace and love.
And just as a reminder, any ideas or topics discussed during this podcast should not be a replacement for any type of medical advice. Although Danielle is a certified trainer and and I have a knowledge of herbal medicine, any decision to incorporate an exercise or herbal remedy is always your own.